In the aftermath of the Parkland, Florida school massacre, the debate on how to react has included a call for greater attention to having mental health treatment provide better care for troubled people, as well as to serve as an early warning system of sorts to prevent another mass shooter. My next guest says there's a problem with that desire, a lack of study and understanding of what creates a school shooter and why. Joining us now to discuss the elements of this issue is the former president of the American Psychological Association, currently a psychologist at Temple University, Dr. Frank Farley. Thanks for being here today, Doctor.
Happy to be here, Chris.
And website for Temple University, if you're in search of quality education, it is temple.edu. And as I said in the introduction, you know, much like when we are worried about getting cancer, we say, well, if I do this, I'll get cancer. If I don't do that, I can avoid cancer, at least improve my chances. That's what you can do with physical health. There's nothing along that line that you can do to predict mental health, is there?
Not much. You know, sure, there's, you know, some obvious behaviors, you know, take care of yourself. Find a meaningful life in the sense that find meaning in family and relationships. Try to find employment that sort of fits your interests, so that you enjoy it and you feel that you're contributing meaningfully to yourself and to your society. You know, a lot of positive things that we hope may inoculate you against some of the worst forms of mental illness. But it's not, you know, predicting, you know, serious mental illness or mental illnesses, some of which we don't fully understand, like mass murderers, is very, very difficult. But, you know, positive relationships, a positive outlook, you know, look on the bright side of life seems very important. Zig Ziglar, the famous motivational speaker, always describes negative thinking as stinking thinking.
Yeah.
And he's absolutely right. There's no future in being negative about everything. And actually, it's amazingly easy to try to look on the positive side. The glass is half full, and you will fill it up, as opposed to it being half empty. You know, sometimes it's hard to do that. But a positive personal attitude is certainly helpful.
And certainly there comes a point where intervention has to take place, which obviously failed with the shooter down in Florida. I mean, there couldn't have been any more warning signs than what that individual was broadcasting. But if you look at clinically, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders doesn't even help the profession out as far as designating, okay, here's a bullet point B, C, D, E, and F, G, whatever, of what is going to create and make that person you have in front of you a mass murderer.
That's right. And we really need this. The way to do it is we have got to study mass murderers in depth and at length. And the big problem here is that they usually end up dead at their own hand or at the hand of others, usually police. And so we don't have a huge number of mass murderers who have been extensively studied. And when that's the situation, how do you know then what the ingredients are in a mass murderer? You can sort of work around the edges by talking to other people. What was this person like? Was there a police record? For example, the shooter in Florida had a police record. Was there any mental health record of any sort, etc.? And what did other people say? What was the school experience? He had been thrown out of school. So there was several ingredients in the recipe that may have been available earlier, and that might have helped perhaps in his case in preventing him, but it might not have. We just don't know. One thing about him is that he is alive. He's incarcerated. If we could get to him, if psychologists could do extensive interviewing and testing, that would be very helpful. I worry that that may not happen. Florida is a capital punishment state, so he's already admitted to this massacre. And so my guess is that a judge is going to sentence him to death very quickly, so that he probably won't be contributing much to science. But that's the problem. You know, you can't go around saying, well, this person has got five things wrong with them, and that's going to lead them to be a mass murderer, so we got to arrest them. You know, in America, you can't incarcerate people for crimes they have not done. You can put them into psychiatric hospitals for observation. And it certainly seems like, you know, that should have happened extensively in this case. But even if you put them in a hospital for observation, will those observations lead you to the conclusion that this person is going to go out and kill 17 people? And it's highly unlikely that you would draw that conclusion just from them being in the hospital and being observed. And if you did draw that conclusion, what are you going to do about it? You know, are you going to arrest someone and charge them criminally with a crime they have not committed? Yeah. So it's a mess, this whole topic. And until we know much, much more about the predictors of mass murder, then we don't have a lot of wiggle room. We really simply need more scientific study, and then maybe we'll be able to learn enough about them that we can, when those signs show up in a person, we can intervene and maybe subject, you know, have them go through psychotherapy and try to change them, so that they will not end up doing mass murder.
Dr. Frank Farley, who is the former president of the American Psychological Association, currently a psychologist at Temple University on the web, it's temple.edu, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. You mentioned, too, of the opportunity to study a single mass shooter, but then as you're saying that, I'm thinking, well, I can go to a casino, I can sit down at a blackjack table, not lose more than I can afford to lose, on a rare occasion even win, strangely enough, but then the person next to me might not have that control. We're in the same environment, same circumstances, and he's going to be outside after he loses all his chips trying to pawn his lungs to get enough money to make another bet. So is the study of one or even a dozen of a case like a mass murder even going to be enough to come up with a consensus of a cause or what creates what a catalyst is for a mass murderer?
That's a really good question, Chris, and my answer is no. We need many more than that. We can't go rushing off with some concept of all the ingredients that go into making a mass murderer when it's based upon a pretty small sample. I was a professor for many years at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and Jeffrey Dahmer, a famous serial killer, was incarcerated about 30 miles or so from my house. I wanted to study him, but he got killed by an inmate quite quickly. So he wasn't available. He's sort of interesting in that he said to the world why he killed people, and he said it was control. He wanted to control people. Okay, well, maybe that's a factor in other serial killers, maybe in mass murderers also, but we don't know, because most of these people don't, you know, tell us why they did it. Again, because usually they're dead, or they don't want to say anything, or maybe they don't fully understand why they did it. So we have a long way to go, but, you know, we can't wait forever. We've got to pull together everything that we do know and hopefully do extensive research on this fellow, Nick Cruz in Florida, and see if, you know, there are cases around the world, too. It's not just here in America. Let's take a look at cases around the world and see what they have found, and hopefully try to begin to develop an intervention to work with kids who show these qualities that we discover in studying mass murderers and begin working with them. You know, that's the way we're going to solve the problem of violence of all type. You know, just sort of one-on-one gun homicides, for example, or other kinds of homicides. We need to find out the early predictors of that and then to try to intervene with kids and to get them at the earliest level. For example, impulse control. The American prison system is full of people with impulse control problems. You know, they just can't control their impulses. They go into a rage. They get mad over something, and they catastrophize it. They make it bigger than it is, and they do something terrible. And end up, you know, either being executed or spending the rest of their life in a cage. And so that's just one thing, impulse control. And the schools can work on that. We can work on teaching kids impulse control. But that's just one factor, you know. We need to know a lot more where mass murderers are concerned.
I have a minute left here, too. Would part of the solution include, because I know mental health professionals are guided by and even prevented through various federal state laws of how much they can divulge about a patient, but should there be maybe officially through the American Psychological Association, perhaps, maybe some other governing body, be a definitive line drawn to tell a professional, okay, if you have a patient and they're approaching this degree or saying things to this level, that on a confidentiality basis, you communicate a concern with law enforcement, keeping everything confidential, much like a patient's records have to be, and just bring law enforcement into a mix if someone gets to a certain point that raises a concern.
Very good point. But we have in psychology what we call duty to warn. And that covers what you're talking about. If the person says something like, I want to kill so-and-so, the professional, the psychologist, has a duty to warn. It gets a little bit tricky, you know, because it's legal territory. And that's not what psychologists do typically, you know. Yeah. We're not lawyers. So it does get a little bit tricky. Does what that client of yours say, does it, you know, does it rise to the point that you feel you must warn someone about it, either the police or the, if you know who the intended target is, warn them. So we do have that provision in the practice of psychology. So we're sort of covered in that at the moment.
Because it just seems like, to the observer, it seems like when we hear about these stories and the obvious backstory of these people, that, well, maybe that aspect of the mental health care profession is being more pushed to the too late of a moment, as opposed to being a little more proactive and going along with that need to warn law enforcement.
Yes, but you can imagine it's kind of tricky. What if they really, it's a joke, they're just joking?
Or on the flip side, psychologists are human beings too. Each individual is going to have their own level of sensitivity. I could say something to psychologist A, and they'll say, "Oh, come on, you shouldn't joke around like that." If I say the same thing to psychologist B, they're calling the police.
That's right, and you can see it's a gray area for a psychologist and a dangerous area. What should they do if it's just an offhanded joke? And the psychologist goes ahead and contacts police, there could be a lawsuit, you know? And so it does get tricky. It's a difficult, very difficult area for any practitioner who's dealing with, you know, psychiatry, psychology, social work, who's dealing with the people with mental illness or with other serious problems. And but it's an important one. One big issue, though, is this, that gun homicides, it's actually a relatively small percentage of gun homicides are due to people with diagnosable mental illness. You know, there's a false belief out there that it's they're all mentally ill. They're not. And it's a fairly small percentage of the total number of gun homicides that are due to mental illness. You know, there are all sorts of other factors. Revenge, you know, getting back at somebody. You got fired on the job and you're mad about it because you feel it was a real injustice. And maybe you've got some impulse control problems anyway, and you've got some anger problems, and it just boils up, and you kill somebody. So there's a stigma about that mental illness is the key ingredient, and you often hear about we need more mental health treatment in America, etc. Well, there's not a problem with that. You know, we need all the mental health facilities that we can possibly have, but let's not overgeneralize that you know, all gun homicides are due to mental illness. They're not.
He is the former president of the American Psychological Association. He's currently a psychologist at Temple University. On the web, it's temple.edu. Dr. Frank Farley, thank you so much for a very educational, insightful conversation. It's a topic you've brought about a greater understanding of this element of the debate, and certainly your ideas are providing will provide a better guidance for the future too, as far as what the needs are to strengthen this aspect of the debate as well. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Chris.